welcome to the 54th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
Here at Reverse Threat Radio, we are still recovering from the momentous event in Mumbai. Shiv Chanderpaul's 150th Test match.
But let's not forget that there are more important things to be looking forward to. And in this episode, we are previewing the Ashes coming up. We're also reviewing David Tossell's book, Following On. Andy's going to be telling us about Mike Gatting's favourite moment. And we're also going to be asking whether cricketers are generally better keeping their mouths shut.
So what aspect of the upcoming Ashes are you looking forward to?
Well, staying up till 4 o'clock in the morning, under the bedsheets.
It is very antisocial of the Australians.
It is very antisocial being on in another time zone.
Do you know, there is something quite nice, though. In this era where we always follow sport live, it's either live text or radio or TV or whatever, there's something very old-fashioned and nice about this idea of you wake up in the morning with that nerve.
And then you find the sport, you look up. Actually, I did that this morning with Tendulkar. I woke up, I was going to get up at four, my alarm clock went off, I turned it off, I went back to sleep, and I woke up in the morning and I sort of, you know, came to it and I suddenly thought, hang on, what's going on? I need to see. And of course, it was all a big anticlimax because the West Indies were being as awful as they predicted we were. Anyway, we digress.
So other than sleep deprivation.
The thing that I'm most looking forward to this Ashes, I think actually, is seeing how some of the sort of second string, maybe second string is a bit harsh, but some of the sort of background characters play. So for instance, we've got a changing keeper for England, potentially, for the first test, and seeing how Johnny Bairstow gets by. Because in a sense, I've never really been... It's amazing to watch Ricky Ponting. Obviously, he's not playing, but in the past, watching your Ricky Pontings, your Vaughans hitting their centuries, that kind of thing. But actually, I think these kind of subplots have suddenly, and we saw it quite a lot over the summer, suddenly where the sort of first-string players aren't performing, and you get these people suddenly shoved into the limelight, suddenly from inappropriate positions. And obviously, Bairstow is the supreme example of that. It's really interesting to see how they cope.
You could really make the case actually in the summer, and I mean I would never call Ian Bell a second string player, but he's not traditionally a player England have looked to as a match winner.
No.
But in the summer where, you know, a lot of England's traditional run scorers, Cook and Trott, didn't deliver, you know, Bell stepped up, and maybe it will be the same.
So what are you looking forward to particularly?
I think it's a relatively fair prediction to make that this is Kevin Peterson's final Ashes series. He's 33, his injury problems are well documented, and I think more than that, there's just an overwhelming sense that he's probably not going to be in Test cricket for that much longer. I think he's an astonishing player, a compelling player to watch, and a player who on his day is capable of things that just very few else who have ever played the game have been capable of. And the last few years have shown that he does have this quite rare ability to play these special match-winning innings, often when England are in trouble abroad. He's done it in India, he's done it in Sri Lanka, and I reckon he'll have his moment.
So here's the question. Why is it that no one's really talking about it? You know, if this is Kevin Peterson's Ashes swan song, why is it that no one's really talking about it? Obviously, partly it's because there are no concrete plans in the diary for him to go.
Yeah, well, I know. I mean, it's interesting. It is a prediction. It's possibly going to... And I mean, it's hard to say, isn't it? Because his commitment to the England side has been doubted at various times, and yet you actually look at the way he delivers and look at the way he respects and treats Test cricket, and I don't think we have any idea, actually, what he's putting himself through to play sometimes. I mean, it's worth thinking back to sort of the Flintoff example. You know, we really don't know until often a long time after the event quite what hardships players are forcing themselves just to get on the field.
So you talk about Peterson's kind of game-changing innings. Do you think he's going to be the difference between the Suicides this summer?
This is something I've probably said about a million times before, but I really think the difference between...
But you really think the West Indies are going to come good sometime soon?
That as well, but I really think there is England without KP as a good side, England with KP on form are just a really, really impressive side. Because suddenly what you have is you have the solid operators, the Cooks and the Trotts, the really solid, efficient, effective operators. And then suddenly you have this maestro playing alongside them who can take games away. And I think what ultimately becomes very, very important for England, and was very, very important for them over the summer, is winning those decisive passages of play. And it's something that Kevin Peterson's very adept at.
And on the flip side, I would say that for Australia, Mitchell Johnson is going to be a really, really key character, because, you know, we saw over the summer that Ryan Harris is a clearly a quality bowler who's able to go out and perform on a regular basis. And he really was the standout Australian player throughout the summer.
So,
but I think that Mitchell Johnson is going to be the... And we hear a lot, and it's difficult to, you know, not actually watching a lot of Australian sort of grey cricket. It's difficult to tell how much of it is hype and how much of it isn't. But we hear a lot about the fact that Mitchell Johnson has become a sort of much more stable bowler, as it were. And if he's able to combine that stability with the completely match-changing days that he was able to bowl in the last series down under.
I think if we were to try to make the case for an Australia victory in this Ashes, I think Mitchell Johnson is a huge part of this. I think what's worth remembering is Mitchell Johnson, purely as a bowler, purely in terms of his bowling action, there's never been any doubt that there's astonishing ability. I mean, I remember when he first came onto the scene and you were like, wow, you know, this guy's fearsome. The problem's always been mental.
It's that combined with those moments where you look at him and there is no more pitiful sight on a cricket field when you know that he's given the ball and the last thing he wants to do is to run in and bowl.
I mean, I think it's worth noting, I'm not a huge fan of the ODIs, but he looked a very impressive bowler actually at times at the end of the summer in the ODIs, looked like somebody who just got himself together. And I think, I mean, he's older, there's a lot of the distractions have gone away. Australia, I think if Australia are to win, he's going to be an absolutely key influence.
But ultimately, I think if there's going to be one prediction that's going to hold true, it's that none of the predictions that we make before the Ashes are ever actually going to
Well, that's
true.
Why I don't think there's any point in making a scoreline.
There's always going to be something that comes up that we don't expect.
Yeah.
From the archives, and one of the most infamous images in the entirety of cricket involves Mike Gatting pointing his finger into the chest of umpire Shakil Rana. And this episode, Andy's going to take us through the story behind this photo.
It's the final over of the second day of the second test of England's 1987 tour of Pakistan. England are well placed. They've made 292 and reduced Pakistan to 106 for 5. Adjusting his field, Mike Gatting informs Salim Malik, who's a non-striker, that he's bringing the fielder up from long leg. As Hemming starts his run-up, Gatting signals to the fielder that he's come far enough. Technically, this is a legal move. Gatting's told the batsman he's not moving a man, and as he's out of the striker's vision, he's not going to cause any distraction. However, from square leg, Pakistani umpire Shakil Rana shouts stop, and his colleague Kizar Khan calls dead ball. Rana then says to Gatting, "You're waving your hand. That's cheating." Gatting explained to him what had happened. Rana walked away and was heard to say, "You are a expletive cheat." This triggered the acrimonious exchange that has earned a place in history, and as Toby noted, it created a very infamous photo. There is a huge amount of dissection to be done here in terms of blame and responsibility and the personalities involved.
And actually, one of the things in terms of the legacy of it, because I actually don't really know anything about the story behind it, but I do know that image. And the impression you get from that image is that Mike Gatting is the aggressor.
Mm.
The umpire is sort of standing there passively, and that's the kind of dynamic behind it. What's the story from your perspective?
Well, I think it is very interesting, firstly, the power of the image. And I think it's a very interesting point, actually, that particularly in an age where, you know, still a lot of people would have looked at the image before, they'd have maybe even seen a video of it, it really does show you, you know, as a cliche, that the camera does lie in certain cases. It made it look like a very one-sided confrontation. Whereas looking at the video, one thing that's very clear...
There is video,
and you can look at it on YouTube, and you can see that both of them are very much... It's an argument. It's not a kind of attack as such. I think to get to the idea of sort of why this happened, you need to look at the personalities both involved. Shakil Rana, in justifying his actions later on, was later say that he did what he did for umpires everywhere. Yet I think this idea of Rana as a victim is kind of very, very hard to maintain. I mean, he was an unusual umpire, to say the least. His first test in 84, he gives 10 LBWs and asks before the final day what the record was. This is in his first test match. This is a man who'd already...
That's admirable, actually. That's a nice attitude to be umpiring one way or other.
Well, he wanted to be
big
a record
out to break records, yeah.
But this is a man who'd already really upset the England side by choosing to wear a Pakistan team sweater earlier in the tour. But I think what probably says the most about Rana and kind of completely belies this idea of him as a kind of innocent in this picture is his actions after the event. So he went on to make a lot of money doing paid interviews. He'd speak to anyone about it. He just wanted to talk more and more about it. And however much he said he regretted it, he never regretted kind of talking about it and discussing it. He liked this newfound fame. And I can, my theory on this is that as a cricketer of just 11 very obscure first-class games, he liked the fact that he had his moment in cricket history. Yeah. And I think it's a really good point that the great umpires are those that understand that they're the supporting cast. They're not supposed to be centre stage. Things have gone wrong if the umpire's centre stage.
I mean, you think of other umpires in Pakistan games and ball tampering incidents in there. Mm. And that idea of umpires being centre stage. But what it would be really interesting to get an idea of, actually, is that... this idea of before umpires became neutral and had to be neutral in inverted commas in the sense of not being from countries that one of the teams playing was from, which came in what, 1992 or was
yes,
it?
Yes, yeah, yeah. I think that's
right, yeah. What the attitude behind umpiring was before that was a kind of conscious issue. Whether umpires generally thought, you know, I actually, you know, I'm from England, I'm from Pakistan, wherever. Therefore, it's kind of quite natural that I didn't give them the benefit of doubt. Because the interesting thing here is that there are two parts of the incident. One of them is the kind of the bare facts of it, which is that, frankly, that if a no ball was called and Gatting was decreed to be won by the umpires, he probably should have said, okay, fine, that's your decision and that's enough. But the thing that changes it is when the umpire makes a statement like, you're a cheat. Mm.
Yeah.
That shows a level of personal involvement with it that is completely different from just a decision which might or might not be wrong.
Well, Gatting recently appeared in a panel at Lord's that was discussing umpiring rights and other things, and he made a point sort of very much along those lines where he said, we've actually got to separate the umpire as the decision maker and the umpire as kind of almost the manager of the game, how they engage with the players. And I think we always focus on the decision making. You know, are we allowing umpires to make the best decisions? But actually, when umpires respect players and talk to them at the right moments, treat them in the right ways, they're actually very capable of diffusing tension. And I think you do see that. You can see those umpires who just have the quiet word in between overs, that sort of thing. I mean, Rana was clearly the opposite extreme of that. I mean, what he did and what he said was incredibly personal and incredibly involved.
Okay, so we've heard about Rana as the kind of perhaps not the ideal umpire. We've heard about what Gatting is thinking in 2012 or whenever it was. Tell me a bit about Gatting's role at the time. What was going through his head, perhaps?
Well, he felt he was always very clear on the fact that he had acted incorrect. You know, he knew that however poorly Rana had treated him, his response was wrong, and his response, I guess, he would admit, was seen as many as inexcusable. But I just think it's very interesting. I mean, he felt that when he was to lose the England captaincy, lose his place in the England team the following summer, it was all talked about, you know, this encounter with a barmaid and stuff. Gatting always maintained that it was the Rana incident that did for him. That was what undermined his reputation in the eyes of the England selectors.
And as you say, as a PR thing, that photo was a complete PR disaster, actually. But that had a lot of impact.
There is
no photo of him with the barmaid, but there is a photo with him with
the picture. And it characterised Gatting as a hothead, as someone who's out of control. And giving this bit of thought, you think, well, what does a momentary lapse say about someone? You know, it had been a long day. It was a tough tour. You know, it was an exhausting tour where England had a lot to deal with. And he snapped at one moment. And I can't help thinking that, in a way, we extrapolate a huge amount from this tiny moment, this tiny slip. And I think, as cricket fans, we're very demanding. And maybe that's something we should be proud of. But a lot of other more tolerant sports, I think they kind of almost expect that aggro. They expect that aggression to come from players. We kind of demand that cricketers take unfairness on the chin. We think that they should have an awful LBW decision and march straight off.
No, I don't think that's true. I think we expect that they should take the umpire's decision on the chin, whether that is right or wrong, not whether they should take unfairness. But as I say, just going back to the original point, I think the difference, the main kind of crux of this is the difference between a decision that is right or wrong, and anyone can argue against that, and then the involvement of an umpire who is clearly taking a part by describing someone as an effing cheat is clearly taking a side one way or other.
Yeah, and I think the accusation of cheating, I mean, given that we are a sport obsessed with this idea of the spirit of cricket, as I said, I mean, there are few accusations that, I mean, in other sports, I think it attracts a lot of unhappiness to be accused of cheating. I think in cricket, it's such a serious, such a severe accusation to make. To the review, and for this episode, we've been reading Following On by David Tossell.
Tossell is a remarkably wide-ranging sports journalist. Over the past three decades, he's written about 12 books on football, cricket, rugby, and American football. And he's twice been shortlisted for the MCC Cricket Society Book of the Year Award. He's currently head of European Public Affairs for the National Football League, the NFL, and he's also a former executive sports editor of the Today newspaper. And by the way, thank you for Wikipedia for that little rundown. So on to this particular book. In 1998, and you probably all remember this, England won the Under-19 Cricket World Cup. And 11 years later, in 2009... many of the players were turning 30, and Tossell decided to go and see where all these players were now. Some of the players were familiar, people like Graham Swan, Oeyed Shah, Robert Key, Graham Napier, are all people whose careers we're familiar with over the last 10 or so years. Other of them are completely unheard of. Essentially, the book devotes a chapter to each player throughout it, combining reminiscences of that World Cup with the stories of their life since. Matthew Engel, the sports writer, said of the book on Radio 4, "Terrific research that I hope is going to start an important debate." What do you think that debate is, and do you think it's important?
I mean, this is a book about the journey from potential to success. You have a tournament that it was actually quite significant because England had never won an ICC limited overs tournament. You know, it may have been an under-19 competition, and you know, I don't think
start small.
Well, and I don't think it played a major part in any of our sort of cricket fan growing up times, but it was quite a significant event for England. And I think this is a very, very clever concept for a book. I think it's a really interesting way of getting to the bottom of why some players make it and why others don't. And what's interesting is that even though we are dealing with lots of little mini biographies, there are lots of common themes. Two of the players who you mentioned that we are familiar with, two very different players actually who've had similar experiences, Oeyed Shah and Rob Key, both of them talk about this idea of the face not fitting, that they weren't quite the right person for Duncan Fletcher's regime. Both of them have these periods where they score huge amounts of runs and just don't kind of force themselves into the reckoning. Do you think we're looking at a kind of victim complex here, or is there sort of fair points that they're making?
It's certainly something that history has sort of borne out in both their cases. I mean, Rob Key perhaps is a slightly moot point in the sense that he hasn't always performed actually Oeyed Shah as well. But there's certainly the sense that we get nowadays when we look at the current England squad that you think that some players simply are blessed with the English management's desire for them to play. You know, Joe Root is one of them. Joe Root's not going to get dropped. Nick Compton didn't have the right face, and no. Nick Compton was someone who got dropped. And actually, it's quite interesting to see these stories going back over a period of time.
I think what's really hard about it, and you get this sense from Shah and Key, is that there's something really hard about just not being seen as the right sort.
Yep.
You know, you're doing everything on the pitch. In some cases, you know, making huge amounts of runs and just being ignored. And I think there must be something very tough about just being damned as not the right sort.
What's interesting is that you talk about this sort of victim complex and what is behind their... and I suspect slightly it's behind the sort of assumption of the interviewer, but it's also behind the assumption of the players themselves, is this thing that we are being hard done by, we are good enough, but we have never been given a proper chance. The flip side of that is that there are some characters in the book who sort of realise that they were never good enough. Basically, they were good enough to be good, essentially, schoolboy cricketers, but they weren't anything beyond that, weren't they?
Yeah, and I think Nick Wilton, who's the wicketkeeper of the side, and apparently really quite an adept wicketkeeper, who's gone on to do some successful coaching with other young English keepers, he talks about the way that he made peace with his failure being that acceptance that deep down, as he puts it, deep down, I probably wasn't good enough to make it. And it's interesting because if you put your failure down to lack of effort, perhaps lack of mental strength, then I think it becomes something that can haunt you. But in a way, what the book, I think, shows is that you almost need to come to terms with the fact, actually, it wasn't quite for me. It wasn't quite right.
Well, one of the things that I found was quite poignant about the book were the players who, unlike Wilton, hadn't given up the game completely, but were still playing in it, and were still playing at, you know, a fairly high level, but were playing for sort of, in a sense, village teams, that kind of thing. And that is that kind of... in a way, you sort of think, well, they've got to under 19 level, say, what, they're 18, 19, and then that was the peak of their career. Everything about their professional career after that was kind of tailing off downhill.
And these players who have to endless second 11 games where they're being paid expenses and having to do painting and decorating to make it
it's almost as if they sort of got to the dream aged 18 and then it was a long tail off afterwards. I mean, do you feel that the game as it's presented at under 19 level is in some ways comparable with the England setup at professional level, or whether they're kind of two completely different things?
I think the point is, a couple of the players who haven't made it, Wilton and Haywood, both point to this idea that they simply had it too easy. Mm. They moved very comfortably from success in school cricket into the England under 19 setup, you know, onto a World Cup victory of the England under 19s. And they said they got to county cricket and suddenly it was hard, really hard. They were having to deal with failure on a routine basis. And mentally, they just struggled with it. And actually, one of the things that really struck a chord with me was this idea, this basic question of, did they enjoy their cricket anymore? And I think there was a couple of quite moving sections where players talked about the fact that actually, they just woke up going off to another second 11 game in the middle of nowhere and thought, I just don't want to do this anymore.
I think one of the excuse me, one of the striking things about the book for me was that when you read sort of supposed exposés of professional cricket in the 21st century, they're kind of, you know, they expose the fact that actually being on tour is very boring and you spend a lot of time sitting around in your hotel room playing on PlayStations, etc., etc. But what was interesting about this book is that actually the expose was the fact that, you know, you can achieve success at a very high level, and then some people go on to deal with it very well by becoming a professional cricketer. Other people deal with it very well by going on and having, in a sense, a completely different career. Even though it might be within cricket, it's not as a cricketer. But then there are other people for whom their lives seem like sort of shadows of that for the rest of their...
And,
well, at least until they're up to when they're 30.
And I think a large part of that is bitterness, actually, in some cases. You see these players for whom they still are angry about that decision. And I mean, the window... One thing all these players' careers make incredibly clear is that the window from which you go from prospect to achieving cricketer is a tiny one. And if you miss your moment, you miss your chance, a whole new generation is suddenly coming through, and you know, it's a very grim reality in that way.
To the debate, and during the past week, Michael Clarke has boldly predicted England's lineup for the first Ashes test. This episode, we ask whether media mind games are a waste of time.
And this is part of what has been an ongoing Australian campaign in the media. I mean, Shane Warne has been speaking constantly about every aspect of England's preparation, of Alistair Cook's captaincy. And it's hard to know whether it's kind of a coordinated thing, whether there's almost been an attempt by Australia to say, let's get at them, let's try and do something. The main thing
just to jump in on that, Shane Warne has also been very, very good at doing down the Australians as well. He, you know, in his attacks on Ricky Ponting is very interesting. In a kind of Twitter question and answer he had the other day, he was asked who he thought the greatest batsmen of his generation were. And, you know, typically the response is that it's Brian Lara, Sachin Tendulkar and Ricky Ponting. And he just said, it's Brian Lara and Sachin Tendulkar.
That's up to Ricky Ponting whether he takes that as a massive personal slight, I suppose. I mean, I wouldn't mind being third to Sachin Tendulkar and Ricky Ponting.
I would.
We digress. The point is that this is almost a routine. You have a test match, you have a World Cup, and these mind games are kind of played very consistently and things are said. And I kind of wonder whether it's got to the stage that, in most instances, it's background noise now. Alistair Cook and most of the England team of what, you know, talking in reference to what Shane Warne had said, they were all very dismissive. They just said, look, it's just not something that we register or we think about, we consider.
Of course it's not, but I don't think it's really about the it's not really about the players, it's about the media. And it's about feeding the media with stories. And you know, we now have a cricket setup that involves, you know, England has X number of people at dinner who more than one person, I don't know how many, who work on the media side of things and the PR side of things.
Yeah.
And this is all part of it. I mean, you have to feed stories to the media. And if you don't have Shane Warne going out there mouthing off about whatever, and you don't have Michael Clarke, because what Michael Clarke did this week when he announced his side, it was a publicity stunt.
Mm.
That's what it was.
Well, no, it was more than a publicity stunt. It was a sense of, like, we've got your number. Like, we understand where you're coming from. We're step ahead of you.
No, hang on. So you're saying that if Nasser Hussein in 2002 had come out and named the Australian side, that it would be Nasser Hussein saying he got the Australian number? Of course.
Well, the origin... Hang on.
Just because a side clearly has a best team... It doesn't mean that, you know, I could go out and pick the English side for the first test, or think that I could pick the English side. It wouldn't mean I've got their number and could beat them. I mean, I probably could.
I think the origin of this, my prediction is, Jose Mourinho as Chelsea manager famously used to do this. He would, in the press conference before, he would say, this is what the other team will be. And, okay, you're quite right, if that team is an outstanding team and far better than you, you know, in the case of, obviously, the Australians, but you're saying it's not going to make a huge difference. But what it's more trying to say, I think, is asserting that we understand how you work as a team. We're a step ahead of you. We have plans for your bowlers. We have plans for your batsmen. We understand what's going on in your camp. You know, there are no secrets from us. And I think it was a statement. And I think, particularly for Michael Clarke, after the summer he had... where he was relentlessly on the defensive. It was a nice opportunity for him to... And what it has succeeded in doing is I've read all these pieces, all these blogs this week about how confident this Australian side look all of a sudden. You know, it's not very clear, frankly, what they've got to be confident about. Specifically, there's not been a... You know, I'm not... They're a very good side, but there's not been a massive transformation all of a sudden on the field. But they have given this quite confident portrayal in the media. I do think, perhaps, with these mind games, it's a question of... who they affect. I think I'd take the example of someone like Alistair Cook. I believe him when he says that he couldn't care about what Shane Warne says. I think actually, go back to 2007, and I don't know if you remember when we reviewed Jared Kimber's excellent book on that series. He talked about the way Shane Warne's constant chirping about Ravi Bapara, he believed that did get into Bapara's head. And I just wonder, maybe for the younger cricketers, maybe for the more experienced cricketers, you know, I hate to name names, but I'm going to. Maybe for a Johnny Bairstow right now.
Well, exactly. Maybe here's another thing. Michael Vaughan came out this week and he said that he didn't think Johnny Bairstow was up to it. Alex Stewart came out and said that he didn't think Johnny Bairstow was up to it. I think there's a difference between ex-players who have become media pundits in their own right. And that is clearly what, you know, Michael Vaughan on, you know, when you hear on TMS sometimes, he is quite biased. You know, the fact that he'll say Swanee and that kind of thing shows
I mean, he's
clearly connected. But there's a difference between that, where he's still able to go out and say things that might damage the confidence of Johnny Bairstow. And Johnny Bairstow needs confidence if he's going to be keeping in the first test. As opposed to this picture that you're potentially painting of... the Australians getting their ex-players together and having a kind of concerted effort to have a media campaign against the English by getting Shane Warne
with Michael Vaughan, it's very interesting, because if anyone, you saw Andrew Strauss's punditry last summer, he was not sufficiently distanced from the players on the pitch.
Oh, he was also as boring and as thick as two players.
Agreed. But Michael Vaughan's now got to the stage where he can be a bit more opinion. But I think you make a very valid point. I imagine that may well have hurt Johnny Bairstow's confidence. Yeah, it's difficult.
I think the reality is that if you try and use ex-players, you are inevitably going to backfire at some point. You know, you are not going to be able to say to Shane Warne, say all the right stuff that's going to help the Australians all the way through, and him not come out and say what he thinks when he's got an old grudge against something. And similarly for any player, really, because everyone's going to have, particularly once they've retired, they're going to have their own things that they want to say.
And these players, again and again, will deny, oh, you know, we don't read the papers, we don't talk. Of course they do. Like, of course they know what's there. But what the question really is do they have any sensitivity to it?
Thank you for listening to the 54th episode of Reverse Rap Radio. We've got a bit of news for you, actually, which is that I am going to be moving to Sydney at the end of this year. I've timed it abominably, so I'm not actually going to be out there for any of the Ashes tests. And actually, the future of Reverse Rap Radio is slightly hanging in the balance as we decide whether it's going to be quite the same doing it over Skype to the other side of the world. But if you do live in Sydney, Andy is very much replaceable, so please get in touch and I'd be very interested to talk.